You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to a new episode of Delirious Nomads, brought to you by Blacklight Media Records, a weekly podcast hosted by yours truly, celebrity chef Chris Santos. I hate calling myself that. And underground metal connoisseur Matt Bacon, who loves being called that. This is your new favorite podcast for all things heavy metal, as well as breakdowns of your favorite combat sports and riffing on some food talk every week with very special guests from across the globe.
Hello and welcome to the Black... Let me try that again. Hello and welcome.
Are you going
to
start with
Okay, well, if you interrupted me, I was going to do it, okay? Vaughn, you got to get me getting character. Okay, I don't have my mojo in your guest room. Hello and welcome to the Blacklight Media... Fuck. Hello and welcome to the Delirious Nomads podcast, hosted by Blacklight Media. I'm Matt Bacon, here with the one and only Chris Santos. Yes, the guy from Chopped. And we are here with our repeat guest, our dear friend, Vaughn Lewis of Unchained Management. How are you, Vaughn? For part two.
I'm good. Thanks for having me on again.
I don't think we're going to edit any of those intros. I think we're just going to have to air it the way it is. And if that happened, everyone just heard what a train wreck that was.
It's rock and roll.
Anyway.
So we're here with Vaughn Lewis, Unchained Management.
Yeah. There was a bunch I wanted to get into on this episode. Because last episode, we talked about sort of your beginnings in the industry, right?
Yep.
But we really didn't get... We sort of got the backstory. We sort of got, okay, you were doing these things. You did this internship that kind of led to the H2O thing, you know, which is sort of how you started managing, right?
Yes.
But we didn't really get into sort of phase two, which is Killswitch Engage, really.
Yes.
You know, because yes. I think you do that Lords of Brooklyn project, and you're doing a few other interesting projects in the late 90s.
Yep.
But I feel like we can really say the next chapter starts in 2001. Would you say that?
Yeah. Accurate? Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Also, if you don't listen to Lords of Brooklyn, you're fucking up. Go listen to Lords of Brooklyn.
Shout out to Caves and Adam from the Lords of Brooklyn.
Can we talk about that? Can we talk about how the Killswitch Engage situation started? Because I feel like that's the...
Sure.
We record these a little in advance of when they actually air, but Killswitch Engage just played yesterday at KnotFest LA. I was unable to go last minute. I couldn't make it, but just a huge gig for them to play in front of. I mean, they've opened for Iron Maiden. They've done the shows before, but talk about a band that really from the cellar to the, you know, among the top of the industry. I want to hear your whole story about how you got involved with them, but how were they at KnotFest and how were they received?
Oh, the show was insane. The tour was amazing. We've been trying to do something with Slipknot here in the States for a while. The shows were insane. Yesterday was a KnotFest show, so it was even bigger. It was an awesome time. And it's ironic that we're talking about how I got started with them because I hung out for a while with Mike Gitter, who was at the show. And, you know, my story with Killswitch Engage really starts with Mike Gitter, who, you know, was an A&R guy at Roadrunner. Before that, he worked at Atlantic. He signed Bad Religion to Atlantic, signed Orange 9mm. I know Mike. Well, I knew of Mike. Mike was a writer. Mike used to write. He used to have his own zine, but then later on, he used to write for Rip. He used to do, write-ups for tour programs. Like when I was a kid, going to big shows and buying a program, a lot of times he would write the liner notes on the program. So Mike was one of those guys who, you know, when you're at that era in New York, you know, I spent a lot of time in record stores. And before Mike even knew who I was, we would see each other in record stores. And I always joke around with Mike. He didn't know me from a hole in the wall, but he would walk up behind me. I'd have like a record in my hand and he'd walk up behind me like, you know, don't get that one. You should get this other one if you don't have it. And then he'd walk away. And that's kind of how I know Mike. So basically from years of, you know, working with a lot of the bands in the punk rock and hardcore scene, and Mike was in and around that, and we got to know each other a bit, and Mike kind of watched me from afar, and he was just about to sign Killswitch to Roadrunner, and, you know, he basically said, you know, I'm about to sign this band. They're kind of, at the time, all the guys in Killswitch were like in other bands, and this band, I guess, started as more of like a local supergroup than something that was going to be real. At least that's the way Roadrunner perceived it, or some people perceived it. I shouldn't say Roadrunner, but some people perceived it.
We're talking first record, like Alive or Just Breathing, or?
Yeah, this, well, Alive or Just Breathing is the first record on Roadrunner.
Okay, got it.
So we're talking before that, but they did have an independent record out on Ferret that was very, like, you know, underground big, like just very underground. Like, people who knew about it loved it. The vast majority of people did not even know it existed. Mm-hmm. So within their little world, that Massachusetts, you know, Northeast world, that record was kind of a big deal, but it was really a big deal for a really small, you know, small group of people. So that record, which was on Ferret, Carl Severson, who started Ferret, was working at Roadrunner at the time. So he was a big part of, you know, Roadrunner being, you know, interested in the band. And, you know, Gitter signed him, and he said, you know what, or was about to sign him. He's like, you know what, you should meet these guys. I think, you know, I think you could be a good fit, just the way you work, and how those guys are.
The Ferret record, what year did that come out?
That would have come out in 2000.
So, like, Shadows Fall, Kilgore, those kind of bands were happening around Massachusetts and Providence?
Yeah.
Well, not even Shadows Fall yet. It was the band that Brian Fair from Killswitch, from Shadows Fall, and Mike D, Overcast.
Overcast.
It was more like that. So again, you know, Mike D was in Overcast. Adam played drums and Joel guitar in a band called Aftershock, with Tom Gomes on drums, who ended up never playing on a record, but he ended up playing drums in Killswitch for a while. Little known fact, you know, a lot of people don't realize Adam played drums on that first Ferret record and Alive or Just Breathing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Another funny aside with that, when they recorded Alive or Just Breathing, they wanted to add a second guitar player. And initially, they were looking for second guitar players because Adam was going to play drums. And when they didn't find anyone that they liked, they had this idea that Adam would move forward and play guitar. And they'd bring in Tom, who they knew from their previous band, to play drums. And at the time, no one was really into that idea because, you know, the band was so good with Adam on drums. So, you know, just kind of a funny aside, because the band is, you know, as good or better with Adam playing guitar. Huh. But so Mike, you know, Mike made an intro. I didn't know a ton about the band. I knew the Ferret record. And, you know, it's one of those things where just really as people, we just clicked. You know, we met, I met them the first time I met them. We drove to a show in Philly. And I think, pretty sure they didn't play. Basically, they were playing, I think it was Stylike 13 in Philly. And someone had robbed the money at the door. And so they didn't play. And so I think we just kind of hung out. And then I saw them again at a big SOU show in Newark. But, you know, really, it was just kind of vibes. They had some demos for Alive or Just Breathing, I think, just at that point. And really, the meeting, you know, it was really just all about whether they were going to make this a real project, whether they were going to tour behind it, because there was some question as to whether this was more a super group and less of an actual thing. And they had this attitude that, let's give it a shot. You know, we want to give it a shot. And my thing with them was, if we're willing to commit a certain amount of time to really see if it works. And, you know, one of the biggest things for them, and this is really good for any band now, one of my biggest things with them was that it takes time to become a self-sufficient band. And I'd seen a lot of bands on Roadrunner, to be honest, a lot of bands that I was friends with, not get themselves to the point where they were self-sufficient quickly enough. And when you can't do that, then you're really dependent on the label, the manager, you're dependent on everything else but yourselves to continue to kind of move forward. And once you lose that support from the label, you're kind of done. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I stress with them as an audience, it was getting self-sufficient really fast to the point where you can kind of dictate what you want to do. And the other thing is,
how do you do that? A as a band? But how do you accomplish that?
Well, I mean, you got to really manage your money, because you can't, you know, if you make some money, you can't just spend it all. You got to put some aside to kind of, it's like running a business. You make some money, you got to put it back into the business. Because if you spend the money and then later on you need the money to do something and you don't have it, then you can't do it and you can't move forward. Right. And what a lot of bands do is, you know, they get some money, maybe they get a deal from the label. Back then there was still tour support. Maybe you get a little tour support. And if you spend it all needlessly, you inevitably are going to need it at some point. And, you know, Roadrunner at that point was really good with tour support. We didn't need a ton in the sense of, as managers, we were really good at budgeting things and, you know, having them not need so much, so that every time I went back to the label, we were able to get what we needed. And it allowed the band to just, you know, self-sufficient, meaning when they went on tour, they started making money. They started selling merchandise. They started getting paid more than what, you know, their van cost, or, you know, this or that. I mean, I'm probably skipping around a bunch, but one of the really major spots for this band was, I mean, I'm skipping around a lot. Obviously, the record came out. The record was really well received. Jesse left the band a little over a month after the record came out.
Which, a little bit of time. Yeah, like, so to the extent that you felt you want to talk about it, like, did you see that coming, or was it a complete fucking surprise for everybody?
I probably didn't see it coming. I probably didn't see him quitting. I mean, we probably had concerns at some points.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it was going to happen that quickly. And, you know, it's crazy to look back at it now, especially with him being back in the band. But it was a bit of a gut punch. And, you know, ultimately he did what was best for him. And I think, you know, in hindsight, it really kind of worked out well for everybody, because he's such the right person now for this band, you know, for so many reasons. Right. I probably didn't see it coming to the extent that it happened. That's another kind of just lesson in how to do things, because when it happened, the record was out. The record was really well received internationally. People loved it. You know, we were working on doing some tours. I'm not going to say who right now, but we were working on a couple of things, and a lot of those opportunities just went away. Like, you know.
So was your vibe, you know, not necessarily speaking for the band, but speaking for yourself, were you like, fuck, what do we do now? Or were you like, all right, you know what, we're going to be able to handle this. We're going to be able to get through this. Like, where were you
at? I was definitely, fuck, what are we going to do now? no doubt about it. I think my thing from the start, and I said this to the band, the band will back me up on this. My thing was, we have to make an attempt to find the right guy. And if we rush into a decision, we're going to hurt ourselves. And, like, you know, to lose someone of that caliber at that point in what was going on, the only way this is going to work is if we take our time and find the absolute best person to do this. And this was probably one of the first things that led to the, you know, first of many pivotal decisions that led to the success of the band, because there was a lot of pressure. You know, there's a lot of pressure from the label. You know, let's find someone. And, you know, the labels had ideas, and we're ready to, like, go on those ideas. And I personally wasn't ready to move on those ideas. And at the same point, I didn't have any ideas, you know. But I think the first good decision was we didn't rush it. We moved fast, but we didn't rush it. We didn't rush to the wrong decision too quickly. And it really would have been extremely easy to do that. We would have made a lot of people happy doing that. Mm-hmm. And within months, it would have been over. So, you know, we did what you do. We set up tryouts. Those guys tried out a bunch of people in Massachusetts. What's great about that situation is Adam is a producer. So Adam had instrumentals and, you know, tried people out, recorded them. We set up a thing in New York. We had a bunch of people come down. We had a little studio. The band came up. Adam recorded those sessions. And, you know, I remember they recorded Howard, and Adam sent it to me. And, you know, they recorded a bunch of other people. And, you know, the Howard one definitely, like, jumped out to me, like, immediately. And I'm like, what about, you know, what's wrong with this guy, you know? And they were like, oh, I'm not sure, you know, we're not sure yet. So we had him come up, you know, to one of the New York tryouts. And I was basically like, that's your guy. Like, you know, that's him. So that's kind of how that came around. But, you know, back to kind of the self-sufficient thing, one of the really key points is, you know, Howard's in the band now for a little over a year, hasn't made a record yet, but the touring has increased. A lot of the phone calls, a lot of the people that weren't answering the phone after Jesse left, they're answering the phones now. And one of the key spots was we you know, I remember it, three different managers. We all sit down in a diner in New Jersey. And, you know, Paul, my friend Paul Conroy, who was managing Lamb and God at the time, Dave Ciencio, who was managing Shadows Fall at the time. The three bands are all kind of, you know, pretty slowly moving up the ranks, but making like a kind of a cultural statement is really what was happening. And we had this idea to do this three band bill, rotate it. And we were all totally copying. I know for me, totally copying, like, you know, the Headbangers, you know, the Clash of the Titans, I should say. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was, you know, a young adult, and when Slayer, Anthrax, and Megadeth went out, and it was a rotating bill, and they each played the same set. I mean, I was, in my head, I was completely biting that model. But the idea was that obviously those three bands were a lot bigger. You know, our bands weren't anywhere near that size. But the idea was, if you put this bill together, put us in clubs, that maybe we might do more business than just ourselves, even though there was a lot of overlap. And I don't think we really understood at the time the cultural statement that was being made. I think anytime something like that's going on, when you're in it, you never really recognize that it's happening. It just mm-hmm. happens. And I remember, and I'll say this, I had this crazy idea, like, wow, you know, Headbangers Ball is just restarting. MTV had just resurrected Headbangers Ball. And I was like, wow, it would be amazing if they would sponsor it. And Paul Conroy immediately was like, well, the people at Epic, Lamb and God's label, are really tight with those people. Let me bring them the idea. Hmm. Brought them the idea, and they were on board. And funny story, you know, Roadrunner didn't want us to do that tour. Essentially, we had toured for a while. They wanted another record. Up to that point, they'd given us bits of tour support for all the different tours that we did. And it wasn't a ton of money, but they definitely gave us money. And the edict was no tour support for this tour. In my head, I'm thinking, you know, we're going to have this Headbangers Ball sponsoring this thing. It's going to be all over MTV. And at that time, you know, getting these bands on MTV wasn't the easiest thing to do. And I'm thinking, like, you know, there's no way these other two bands are going to go on this tour, you know, with this idea that I kind of partly came up with without my band. Like, it's got to, you know, we have to make it happen. So long story short, all the work that we had done up to this point, and I didn't know this was going to be the case, but when the agents went out and started to get offers for this tour and I started doing budgets, I realized, like, wow, you know, we can afford to do this on our own. We can afford to do this in a bus on our own, with no help from the label, and we'll still come on with some money, and, you know, we'll sell some merchandise. You know, we had to sit down with the band, and they're like, let's do it. You know, and I went back to the label, like, we're doing it, you know, sorry, you know, this is happening. And that tour really changed the game for everybody. It changed the game for us, changed it for Shadows Fall, changed it for Lamb of God, and it changed it for bands that came after us. That's an example of where the self-sufficiency really came into play, because in another situation, we would have had to just do what we were told. And when we put out the next record, and I forget the numbers, but we were probably at like 100,000 records sold with Alive or Just Breathing, as opposed to like 60,000 records sold, which is where we would have been had we stopped at that point. And, you know, it's a big difference. Like, you basically raised the platform, and now you're putting out a record that has a bigger platform than it would have had if you'd put it out a year before. And that record ended up going gold. I rambled a bit, but, you know, hanging out with Mike Gitter yesterday, we were just watching the band and watching them in this crowd. And, you know, we had to kind of chuckle at just how much I told him, thank you for changing my life. And he's like, well, you changed my life too. And the reality is, we all change each other's lives. Just that casual, I think you're a fit.
Great story, first of all. Thanks for sharing. But so then you do that, you know, and then you get the gold record, and you, all your bets are paying off, and this tour is paying off. And then some time goes by, and then Howard announces he's leaving.
Yes.
And then are you like, what the fuck again? Like, what are we going to do? Or was it, you know, you'd go to Jesse right then and there?
No. A little bit of a different situation. That really was a situation where, you know, I kind of saw it coming. and kind of knew that we were going to have to do the thing again. You know, at the time, I honestly didn't think that Jesse, you know, would do it, to be honest. It had come up, to be honest, it had come up once before. It didn't make sense for him. And, you know, we were doing Times of Grace, so it wasn't like we were all talking. But in fairness to Jesse, you know, we basically did the thing where we put out a thing. Howard's, you know, leaving the band. We're looking for a singer. I think Jesse hit up Adam. Adam was in town the day that we made the announcement. It was kind of funny. We were at a bar, you know, and Adam and mine and Kenny's cell phone are just like, you know, going to the roof because we literally just made this announcement. You know, we're all just like, oh God, you know. And at that point, Jesse reached out to Adam, and then I had a conversation with Jesse. And to Jesse's credit, Jesse, and people still don't believe me when I say this, but he tried out like everybody else. We sent everybody songs. Obviously, for Jesse, we didn't have to send him his own songs. We sent him Howard songs. And, you know, he definitely had some special treatment in that, you know, we had a room and we didn't want anybody to see that, you know, we didn't want the other singers to see him. So we had him come at the end. He tried out, I think he did 2 or 3 Howard songs. And then just for fun, he did like 2 or 3 of his songs. I remember Monty Connor was in the room at the time. At this point, you know, Mike is no longer at Roadrunner, and Monty's technically our A&R guy, and Monty was there. And, you know, Jesse hung out for a little bit. He left, and we all looked at each other like, wow, that felt great. And that was that. I honestly didn't think that that's how it would turn out. I didn't think Jesse would do it. Honestly, I didn't think he would be interested.
And that's a decade ago now, almost.
It is literally a decade ago. Yeah.
It's crazy.
He tried out, we announced him in the band, I think it was January of 2011. So yeah, played a first show at Metal, I think it was Metal Fest in April, March or April of 2011. So a decade ago.
I remember we had a benefit at Vandal, one of my previous restaurants in New York City. And it was for Hope for the Day, yes. You know, and Jesse and Howard were in the same room for, I don't know if it was the first time, but it was like one of their first times kind of. And but people seeing them together and talking.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you remember
Mortal Enemies or something.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you remember this, but I was definitely a big part of you know, because we ended up, you know, I'm very good friends with Howard. I ended up working with his band again, which was kind of crazy when you think about it. And I literally called all of the guys in Killswitch to let them know that, look, I'm thinking about doing this. I hope you guys are going to be okay with this. And they were all okay with it. And, you know, and they were all in touch to a degree, but I don't know if you remember this, Chris, but I forget what was going on. We're all in Vegas and Killswitch was playing a show in Winnipeg, and Howard went to the show because he was living there at the time. And I had no idea he was going to the show. He didn't tell me he was going. I had no idea. And Chris, you walked over and you put your cell phone in my face, and it was a photo of the 5 of them and Howard.
Yeah.
And my jaw hit the floor because no one told me he was coming. No one told me. Howard didn't come, ask me to put him on the list, like nothing. And like the internet, like just like broke. And then I started getting texts from all the guys. Like, it was so great to see him, you know, yada, yada, yada. But I still tell people that story. What was that?
You work with Howard now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we started working with Howard again in, I don't know, maybe 2017 or 16.
Light the Torch, right?
Yeah. Basically, once the Devil You Know became Light the Torch, we've been working with them.
Yeah, great records.
So, yeah, you know, COVID's really hurt a lot of things because that record came out. They were supposed to go out on tour. That tour didn't happen. So, but we've got. I guess I can say this here now because this is not going to air for a little bit, but on, you know, by the time this thing airs, it will be the rescheduled Killswitch, August Burns Red, Light the Torch tour is going to be announced.
Oh, great.
So those bands are going to be on tour together, you know, which That's is even, you know, even more insane.
So we might see Howard and Jesse on stage together is what you're saying?
Possibly. Possibly. I mean, they've done it a couple times.
And so what other notable bands are you working with that maybe our listeners might not know?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's bands that I'm working with now. There's bands that I work with. I mean, I work with Azalea Dying.
Are you with All That Remains? Is that right?
Work with All That Remains for a little bit. I'm not working with them now. Okay. Work with a band called Memphis Mayfire. that's doing really well, has had some singles that have come out from their upcoming record that's coming out next year that are doing really well. You know, we work with Lorna Shore, more so Jason in our office, and they're doing really well. And they kind of had like a viral moment that they've been able to kind of build on. The Contortionists do well. It's just always a weird thing. Like, I don't want to forget anything. I don't know if I can say this here, but Matt has a couple of bands that we're going to help him with, including Capra, who's signed to your label.
Yep, yep.
And Squilla Grind. Do some things outside of the metal world. We do this guy, William Elliott Whitmore, who's like a kind of a punk, country, bluegrass sort of guy. It's just him and a banjo or a guitar and him beating on the drums. And then some of the things that we've done in the past, you know, notably, I mean, I work with As They Dying, two different stints for a long time. You know, when they kind of really came to prominence, kind of in that second wave behind bands like Killswitch and Lamb of God, we were the managers during that time frame. I'm sure I'm missing some that I'm going to get in trouble for.
Chris's former chef, Brian Sow, you manage both his career and his very good hardcore-ish band, Lost of Thumbs.
Yes.
Did you see them recently when they opened for
Moontooth?
Yeah, they played with Moontooth.
No, it's not that show.
At St. Vitus.
Yeah, that crazy band from...
Drawing a Blank. They were really good. But yes, I was at that show. I'm just drawing a blank.
Yeah.
All the shows become a blur.
I have yet to see Lost Becomes Live, and I would really love to see them. We like them at the label, is what I'll say.
You got to see them.
But I haven't seen them yet, yeah.
You definitely got to see them.
No, there's definitely... Vaughn and I saw them in Long Island over the summer, and there are some riffs that just, like, are mean.
Brian's no joke.
100%. Which is funny, because the last time I saw him perform was at, like, Pink's, this tiny little bar that we all know and love.
Yes.
Where he was basically playing covers, like rock and roll.
I remember.
What he's doing in Lost Becomes. Like, what do you look for in a band? What makes a band worthy of your representation? And vice versa, what does a band look for that you guys, excel at? I guess I don't know enough about the management side, so I'm curious about.
Well, I mean, what we look for is, I mean, really simply, you know, enough of us have to like it. I mean, that's the first thing. We have to like it, because that's a big deal for me. You know, for me, a big thing is, if I'm going to get on a plane and fly to go see a band that I manage, am I going to be excited? And this is a litmus test that I put on myself a long time ago. When people are, you know, so a lot of times people will give you bands like, oh, you should, you know, work with these guys. You know, they're hot. This is happening. That's happening. And I say to myself, okay, if I got to go and see this band, am I going to be psyched to see them? Because I go to shows. I buy tickets. I go to shows. And I like, it's a big part of my life. So I got to like a band. If I'm going to get on a plane and be bummed, then I don't want to manage them. You know, I'm joking around. But yesterday I flew from New York to L.A. I was only in L.A. for about 9 hours. And then I flew, I got a 10:30 flight out to get to Vegas because I needed to be in Vegas today. I got to really like that band. If I'm going to, you know, be in three cities in 15 hours, I got to be into it. So that's one. Two is, you know, just do they have potential? Like what's their ceiling? Do they have the ability to move from you know, point A to point B, C, D, and beyond? And I think that's one of the things that we're good at. I think we're really good at like developing bands from an early point and, you know, moving it up the ladder. So, and that's a really kind of esoteric thing. Like what, you know, it's, you don't know, you don't necessarily, you can't guarantee it, but do you think they've got something that can kind of move them up the ladder and take them to the next level? Then the intrinsic things is, are they hardworking? You know, are they good guys? Do you, in addition to liking the music, do you want to hang out with them? Because when you manage the band, you spend a lot of time on the phone. You spend, you know, a lot of emails back and forth. Now the age of texting, a lot of texting. And if they tour a lot of time around them hanging out.
Yeah.
It's really those simple things, you know, are they doing something different? It's always exciting to get involved with something that sounds different, that feels different, that's got something that you necessarily can't put your finger on happening. So I'm probably being really super vague about it, but it's a lot of gut, honestly. you know, bands, a lot of times when bands are looking for managers, or, you know, maybe it's even the other way around, where maybe they're not even looking, but you're so into them that you want to manage them. A lot of times bands don't necessarily know what they need in a manager or what they want in a manager. You know, a lot of times what they think they need is actually what they need. You know, sometimes they think, okay, we need a record deal. Can you get us a record deal? You know, we need an agent, or we need a better agent than the one that we have. Can you get us a better agent than the one you have? And when in reality, what they need is, you know, what managers do, it's a lot of planning. It's a lot of just kind of looking down the road, working with someone to see where they see themselves down the road and come up with a plan. If everybody agrees that that's the road, that that's where they want to get to, that makes sense, come up with a plan to get there. And I think that's what we do. We kind of sit down and say, okay, if you want to get here, how are you going to do that? What are the things that work for you as a band? Do you want to tour with these kind of bands? Do you want to tour with those kind of bands? Doesn't matter what kind of bands you tour with. A lot of times as a manager, you try to convince a band to do some tours that are a little outside of what's obvious. You know, I know for Killswitch and a band like Azalea Dying and even H2O in the beginning, you know, we did a lot of things that people didn't necessarily see us doing. You know, when Killswitch did Warped Tour, people were like, that's, you know, like, why would they do Warped Tour? And we were like one of the first, you know, Hatebreed was probably like first, but we were one of the first like kind of heavy bands to do Warped Tour. And I think we opened up the door for a lot of other bands to do it. It's a lot of that. Those are like the extra bells and whistles that a manager can bring to the table. Is just because when you're not in the band, and you're not in that tunnel, a lot of times you can look at things from afar and see things that they don't see. And, you know, you bring it to them and you see where it goes. You know, there's all these decision making, you know, like I was talking about, you know, a singer, like taking your time, finding the right guy, you know, knowing when to stay on the road, knowing when to come off the road, knowing how in a record cycle to do different types of tours. Don't just tour. You know, one of my kind of pet peeves with what the business has become is, you know, when I was young, you know, bands under like the heavy genre toured with lots of different styles of heavy bands within that genre. You know, when Metallica toured with Ozzy, you know, that was kind of a crazy thing when that happened. I mean, now, you know, it doesn't look that way, but when that happened, like Metallica was this like thrash band, you know, touring with Ozzy Osbourne, you know, who was in like his, the kind of the hair metal days, the Ultimate Sin album.
Yeah, was the Ultimate Sin was Metallica? Because wasn't it Motley Crue and then Metallica was the next opener for
Ozzy? Well, Motley Crue toured with Ozzy on, I think Ozzy was on Bark at the Moon at that point.
Okay.
I think that was like 83.
Okay.
The Metallica tour was like a couple years later. And, you know, that was nuts. Like Metallica's touring with Ozzy, like that, it was nuts. But I think over time, we kind of got into this thing where, you know, if you're a metalcore band, you tour with other metalcore bands. And, you know, I don't think that's healthy. I didn't
realize until today that Greta Van Fleet is opening for Metallica.
Yeah, they're doing a couple shows, like four or five shows.
I love Greta Van Fleet, and I think they're an amazing live band, but I hate that tour. It's just like,
it's weird.
But it speaks to what you're saying, doing something different and outside the box.
Wait.
Yeah. Chris, well,
can I share the dirty secret of Metallica no one will admit, and that will get eye rolls from both of you?
All right.
Metallica is not a thrash metal band. They're a 90s rock band.
Well, I mean, now, but
I mean, I'm just saying, like,
But they play a lot of deep cuts off the first.
No, they do. Right? And I give them credit, but I'm saying, like, the fan base is a 90s rock fan base, and nobody wants to admit that.
I don't know that the guy going to see Metallica wants to see Greta Van Fleet. I don't think so.
I think there's a portion of the fan base that won't want to see that. I think maybe there is some that are okay with it. What I will tell you is,
I think they'd want to see Killswitch.
Yeah, I mean,
one day.
Yeah, one day. Yeah, I mean, I still think though, and Matt, maybe you have a point now. I'm not going to cop to that, but certainly in '86 when they toured with Ozzy, they were dangerous. They were as thrash as you get.
Yeah,
and you know what I will say to that too, Chris, is maybe some of the fan base won't like it. Maybe a lot of it won't like it. But I do think that it's important. I mean, they're playing stadium. You know, I think those shows are stadium shows.
Yeah.
I think it's important to, like, give a different look. Like, you know, open. I think as a big band, I think when you take out other bands, I think ideally it reflects to some degree what you like, you know, and you should challenge your audience a little bit. You know, maybe they're doing it because they're getting played on the radio and they just need more tickets. You know, I don't know.
I get it. I just, like, I see, like, Exodus coming out with what on the surface looks like it's going to be one of their best records ever. Yep. And, you know, I want to see Metallica with Exodus. Sorry.
I get that. And listen, I also would like to see them, you know, like they have done, you know, they took out Lamb of God, you know, they took out Machine Head. I'd also like to see them kind of, you know, look at some band, you know, some more bands that they influenced and take them out. Metallica, please take out Killswitch.
That's the point of this podcast. We are running towards the end, though, because Chris has to go do fight things.
I do. I have to go fight people. No. You know, I am putting a little musical thing together, and we are getting closer and closer to actually making it happen. I'm going to be doing a little project with Monty Pittman.
Nice.
I'm scared to death.
I owe Monty a call.
I've been playing drums every day, and I still feel, and he's like, let's just get in a room and do it. And I'm like, I cannot get in a room with you. I'm not ready yet, but we're getting very close because he's running out of patience with me. He's just going to make me get in a room with him. But, you know, I may
Monty likes to move.
I might be calling you up with some questions in the future. I mean, I've got a label, so I know where I'm going to put the music out on. But then beyond that, I might need some help. So please, you'll be the first call I make.
Love you. And I love Monty. Monty's a good friend.
Hopefully I can, you know, gosh, I hope we can do it justice. We'll see. awesome. But anyway, thank you for being on the show. Not once, but twice.
Thanks for having me.
I know how busy you are. So it really means a lot. It's really fascinating hearing the management side of things. It's just something I don't know anything about. And it's been a really two fascinating conversations. So thank you very, very much.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. It's honestly an honor to do this with you guys. This is great. Nah,
for sure. For sure. And I hope to see you soon. I run into you all the time, so I'm sure I'll see you soon.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Matt Macon, always lovely to hear your voice. Sort of, I guess. Everyone out there, thanks for listening. We've got some great guests coming up in November, December, and into January. So keep listening, and we will keep bringing all the fun.
And I'm going to go call HR at Metal Blade.
You should. I can't believe it's taken you 30 episodes. Like, for real. Come on, get it together, kid. All right.
Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Take care.
All righty. Thanks.
All right. So that was awesome. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening to Delirious Nomads, sponsored by Blacklight Media. We will be coming back at you next week with another awesome guest. Be sure to follow Blacklight Media on socials for new music and more. And above all, keep it heavy.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
It is now 2024, and the choice is up to you. Do you listen to good podcasts, or do you listen to bad ones? Well, we've got a suggestion for you. How about you listen to a good podcast for the first time in your miserable life? I can think of one. Overnight Drive. Going strong. 11 years now. The podcast about nothing. Your favorite podcast's favorite podcast. Do you enjoy nothing? So do we. Why don't you come over and check it out and stop listening to other podcasts? Thank you.